out of spring or an itch. Pain that swell in a twitch. Call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky. Call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. I guess this week the saga of the coronavirus, now considered a pandemic, needs to continue. The coronavirus has infected more than 100,000 people worldwide, so it's natural that we all may get a little anxious every time that we feel a tickle in the throat or the beginnings of a bad cough.
First, let us start with some good news. While the coronavirus is certainly something to take seriously, the chances of any individual person getting it are still low.
So every time we get one or more of these symptoms, we all naturally wonder, which one is it? Allergy? Flu? The common cold or coronavirus. First, let's start by calling it COVID-19, COVID-19, the favored name of this virus now. So if you have itchy eyes, stuffy nose with sneezing, then it's, well, most likely an allergy or just the common cold. If, however, there's fever, fatigue, generalized body aches, and cough, as well as worsening symptoms, then you might start thinking about the flu or coronavirus.
So, if you're suspicious of this being the cause of your symptoms, then look for shortness of breath and history of travel or exposure. The coronavirus and flu symptoms tend to be more systemic than the common cold and allergies. In other words, they affect the whole body.
On the other hand, the flu and COVID-19 more often affect other symptoms and the lower respiratory tract, which means the lungs. That's where the cough and difficulty breathing come from.
You probably won't have a runny nose, but what you still might have is a sore throat, a cough, a fever, or shortness of breath. So it is a subtly different clinical diagnosis.
Allergies are just unlikely to cause a fever or shortness of breath unless you have a pre-existing condition like asthma. Allergy symptoms are regularly occurring and usually mild.
And if you have had the same symptoms around the same time, year after year, you're probably experiencing seasonal allergies. But of course, you can't be sure, so be vigilant.
With an acute case of coronavirus or flu, you'll feel so tired, so achy, you'd basically be driven to bed. Although allergies may make you feel tired, they're not going to cause the severe muscle or joint aches. With normal illnesses, you'll start feeling better with rest and proper care within a few days, unless you're elderly or have other health conditions, in which case even the mild illnesses may take longer to pass.
Coronavirus and acute flu symptoms often get worse over time. If you have a nasty case of the flu or coronavirus, you may get worse when you expect to get better. This is a sure sign to seek medical care.
The catchphrase here for coronavirus is shortness of breath. People can also develop pneumonia from the flu, which has a similar presentation. So either way, you're going to want to seek medical attention. Now, here are the questions that an ER physician is likely to ask if he or she is considering COVID-19 as a possible diagnosis of your ills. First, have you traveled recently? And if so, where? Have you had anybody in your home or had a workmate or schoolmate who's traveled? Where did they go?
Have you had anybody in your home from areas where the outbreak is most concentrated? Have you been on a cruise ship?
Do you live near an area where there's an outbreak? You should also remember that just because it isn't the coronavirus doesn't mean that it isn't serious.
In the last few months, 30 million Americans have been infected with the influenza virus. About 300,000 to 500,000 of them so severe they had to be hospitalized, and about 30,000 of them die.
We're so culturally numb to the flu that we don't take it seriously despite these numbers. And in contrast, the coronavirus has killed about 3,300 in roughly the same time. So with the statistical difference in death rates, the flu is more prevalent and far more likely to be a problem for the average person.
When you have 30 million infected, it is easy to infect that next 10 million. So with COVID-19 panic, we are forgetting about the flu.
So bottom line, take precautions to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. It's up to you to stay vigilant, taking into account your medical history, monitoring your symptoms, and thinking critically about whether your specific situation puts you at risk. Now, here's another interesting fact that may have been noted concerning the American general reaction to COVID-19.
We know from the news that supplies of masks were the first to show scarcity. This was followed by hand sanitizers.
But why toilet paper? Not just in the U.S., but Canada and Australia as well.
Funny as it seems, an Australian newspaper went so far as printing 8 extra pages in a recent edition as emergency toilet paper should the Aussies run out.
The question is why? Toilet paper does not offer any special protection against the virus. It's not considered a staple of impending emergencies like milk and bread are. So why are people buying up rolls more quickly than they can be restocked?
First of all, people resort to extremes when they hear conflicting messages. Stephen Taylor, a clinical psychologist and author of The Psychology of Pandemics, said that we should take a history look at how people behave and respond to pandemics.
Compared to past pandemics, the global response to the new coronavirus has been one of widespread panic. On the one hand, the response is understandable, but on the other hand, it's excessive. We should be preparing, not panicking.
As you've probably seen or heard, gaps widen between White House and health agencies over coronavirus.
COVID-19 scares people because it's new, and there's a lot about it that's still unknown. When people hear conflicting messages about the risks and how seriously they should prepare for it, they tend to resort to the extreme again.
When people are told something dangerous is coming, but all you need to do is wash your hands, the simplicity of the action doesn't seem proportionate to the threat.
Some people are simply reacting to the lack of a clear direction from officials. We have read that in several countries there have already been massive quarantines. People buying up toilet paper and other household supplies may be preparing for the same thing in their city.
Again, unless people have seen or heard official promises that everyone will be taken care of, they are left to guess at the probability of needing the extra toilet paper sooner rather than later.
And panic buying brings on more panic buying. Images of empty shelves and shopping carts piled high with supplies have inundated the news reports and even the social feeds. People who see images of panic buyers assume there's got to be a reason to panic and buy up supplies as well.
People are social beings. We look to each other for cues for what is safe and what is dangerous. So when you see someone in the store panic buying, that can cause a domino effect of fear.
All those photos of empty shelves lead people to believe that they must rush out and grab toilet paper while they still can. And what started as perceived scarcity becomes an actual scarcity. Social media is a huge player in the coronavirus fear-mongering.
Misinformation spreads with ease, and open platforms amplify voices of panic. And finally, it is natural for us all to want to over-prepare.
You know the sayings like, better late than never, better safe than sorry. We learned those when we were kids. With the CDC and other international health agencies now advising that certain populations should stay home and avoid contact with other people or crowds, it's natural to want to stock up on necessary items.
Besides, you will be spending money on toilet paper at one point or another. The only extra costs are the hassle of doing it sooner rather than later, contending with long lines and having difficulty finding it. After all, it is a non-perishable item.
And remember, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security advises Americans to keep at least 2 weeks' worth of food, toiletries, and medical supplies on hand anyway. This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center.
I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 33 years.
We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. Let's get away from the coronavirus. After all, we've spent at least three previous shows focused on it. Obesity is a world problem that is no different here in the U.S. Being overweight or obese can simply be a health hazard. And yet the prevalence of obesity was 42.4% in 2017 to 2018. And this has increased from 1999, when the prevalence of obesity was 30.5%, to the 42.4% I mentioned above.
Obesity-related conditions include heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and certain types of cancer that are some of the leading causes of preventable premature death.
Then there's the cost of obesity in the United States. It's around $147 billion in 2008 dollars. This means that the medical cost for people who have obesity was $1,429 higher than those of normal weight people. Non-Hispanic blacks had the highest age-adjusted prevalence of obesity, that being 49.6%, while Hispanics had a 44.8%, and then non-Hispanic whites had a prevalence of 42.2%. The non-Hispanic Asians, they came in a distant 17.4%.
Many people with obesity also develop high blood pressure, but the mechanism that leads to this still remains unclear. A new study, though, may have the answer for us.
In this new study, researchers from the University of Virginia School of Medicine in Charlottesville have turned their attention to the endothelium, the layer of cells that line the blood vessels themselves. To understand this, we need to delve into anatomophysiology for just a bit.
To regulate blood flow, vessels dilate and contract as appropriate. There are calcium ions both inside and outside of our cells. These calcium ions communicate with the cells, regulating vasodilatation by effectively telling the vessels when to dilate.
In obesity, however, calcium signaling within blood vessels appears to be impaired. This affects the vasodilatation and contributes to high blood pressure. So far, so good. But to understand more about the specific causes behind high blood pressure in obesity, we need to learn and understand a wee bit more. The researchers found that normally a protein called TRPV4, which is present on the membranes of endothelial cells, allows calcium ions to enter the cells and maintain normal blood pressure.
However, in obesity, this protein stops working in what are called the myoendothelial projections, which happen to be very specialized extensions of the endothelial cells.
You know, under normal, healthy conditions, TRPV4 helps maintain normal blood pressure at these tiny myoendothelial projections. However, when not everything works as it should, these key entry points for calcium simply become pathological. In obesity, the segments of endothelial cells that hold the TRPV4 exhibit an increase in the levels of enzymes that produce the peroxynitrite.
This ion, in turn, silence TRPV4, thus stopping calcium from entering the epithelial cells. This, in turn, leads to poor regulation of blood pressure, potentially causing it to become elevated.
Knowing this mechanism is important, since it may hold the key to new medications to control high blood pressure or hypertension. You might ask yourself, why is this so hard to do? Why not use a drug to directly activate TRPV4? Well, the problem is that TRPV4 is present in many other tissues, including brain, muscles, and bladder, and not just the blood vessels.
So you can't just find some chemical to directly activate TRPV4. You just might get undesirable side effects. The better approach would be to target the specific events that reduce TRPV4 function in obesity.
So the researchers are looking for something that activates directly on either the peroxynitrite or the enzymes that produce it. Now, this approach might help regulate blood pressure without causing unwanted effects. If this is successful, then researchers might be able to design drugs that specifically target peroxynitrite and provide therapeutic benefit. At the beginning of the show, I said that we would not talk more about COVID-19. But the next topic does relate to some degree to the prevention of getting the COVID-19 infection. Did you know that you probably touch your face 16 times an hour?
The reason that we say that the topic is related is because touching your face can significantly increase the risk of infection with flu or cold viruses and the new coronavirus.
Remember that your eyes and mouth are areas where viruses can easily enter your body. We touch our faces so often, the odds of recontaminating our hands between washings are extremely high.
Some experts say wearing gloves can help you break the habit of frequently touching your face. You know that you do it. We all do it. We touch our faces countless times every day.
An itchy nose, tired eyes, wiping your mouth with the back of your hand are all things we do without even a second thought. Your mouth and eyes are areas where viruses can enter the body most easily, and all it takes is touching them with a finger already carrying an infection.
While we can easily avoid being around someone who's obviously sick or take precautions against airborne viruses using a mask, avoiding the virus when it's on a surface is almost impossible.
In one 2008 study, 10 subjects were each observed alone in an office environment for 3 hours. That's where that average of 16 times per hour comes from.
An Australian study of medical students showed that they touched their faces 23 times per hour. Almost half of their faces touches involve the mouth, nose, or eyes, which are the easiest pathways for viruses and bacteria to enter our bodies.
When actively working, people will often shake their foot, play with their hair, or in these instances, touch their faces. It certainly helps to know when you are most vulnerable to such activities and try to stay aware during the meeting or phone call or while engrossed in work. So take precautions like washing your hands often and using at least 20 seconds to do so. But this can only help if we also avoid touching our faces, as there's no way of knowing when you've picked up a tiny and potentially deadly passenger. According to the CDC, effective hand washing consists of 5 simple steps. These are wet, lather, scrub, rinse, and dry.
However, we touch our faces so often that the odds of recontaminating our hands between washing are extremely high. All it takes is touching a doorknob or similar surface and you are in danger of infection again. A new ring, jewelry, or even a rubber band around the wrist can serve as a reminder to increase awareness of the hands and ideally to remember something simply needs to be different to encourage different and non-automatic behavior. It actually helps to place reminders like post-it notes in your home or office so you can see them and remember you want to keep your hands away from your face, said one researcher.
I can just see someone writing an app for the smartphone that screams out to you every time your hands go to your face, something like, don't touch your face, or maybe the same at regular intervals. You can try keeping your hands busy. If you're at home watching TV, try folding laundry, sort through mail, or hold something in your hands.
A suggestion is to use a scented hand sanitizer or a scented hand soap to help remind yourself to keep hands away from your face. The smell will draw your attention to the location of your hands.
If you're in a meeting or sitting in a class, maybe you can lace your fingers together, place them in your lap. Finally, if you know you habitually touch your face, you could wear gloves. This can be a very effective physical reminder. The bottom line is that your eyes, nose, and mouth are the easiest path for a virus like COVID-19 to enter the body.
All it takes is touching these areas with your hands after you have come in contact with the disease on a surface you touched. No matter how frequently you wash your hands, it is not often enough to prevent passing an infection into your system. The best preventive measure is to avoid touching your face as much as possible.
They've come out with a new weight loss pill that has been approved by the FDA. It has a great name, Plenity. Unfortunately, it will not be available until this fall, a good 6 months from now. The company that manufactured it is Gelesis, and they say that they need to raise funds for marketing and manufacturing, as well as to set up a distribution system. Now, even though Plenity is a pill, the FDA considers it a device, since the pill works by releasing particles into the digestive system that expand after a person drinks water before a meal. Remember that we said that obesity is a growing concern worldwide? So this drug may be in quite a bit of demand once it is placed on the market. You know, we as Americans are used to drug delays. After Plenity was approved, Gelesis went looking for the investors that we mentioned to help support its launch.
In December, the company announced it had received $84 million in capital to help support a large-scale commercial availability.
But Plenity will only be available through a prescription from your doctor. The pill is approved for use in people with a BMI of 25 to 40 or people who are considered to be overweight or have obesity. The significance of Plenity's approval is that it can be used for the BMI measurement as low as 25 when one is only considered overweight and not simply obese. Most medications that are now on the market that are now approved for people are with BMIs of 30 or above, indicating that the person is obese.
Inside the gelatin capsules of Plenity are thousands of absorbent hydrogel particles, which are made of cellulose and citric acid.
According to the manufacturer, when consumed with multiple glasses of water, the particles can expand to 100 times their original weight. While in the stomach and small intestine, the particles make a person feel full before a meal, which makes them, well, less inclined to overeat. First thing I thought of was drinking several glasses of water in and of itself might make you feel full.
The reason Plenity is considered a device and not a drug is because those suspended particles pass through a person's digestive system and are excreted during a bowel movement.
Plenity is simply not absorbed into the bloodstream during any part of the process, so the federal government treats it as particles, like we said, and therefore like parts of a machine, rather than a chemical that affects the way a person's body operates. People are supposed to take 1 3-pill pack with water before lunch and dinner.
Even in testing, people who took Plenity were also required to undergo a weight management program of nutrition, diet, and exercise.
Plenity's potential side effects include gastrointestinal problems such as obstruction, diarrhea, constipation, and also dehydration, and, unfortunately, even weight gain.
Genetics, lifestyle, and activity level contribute to someone's ultimate weight. So each person responds uniquely to every medication, product, or intervention.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana.
We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.